This is edition number 1966 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 9th of May 2025. Hello and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 5 in the morning and sets at around 25 past 8 in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 8th of May. I am Bill Newby Grant, and my fellow readers are
Marilyn Evans,
Hilary Newby Grant,
and Jill Mellows.
The magazine supplement, which includes Happy Times on the Broads, A Blickling Anniversary, The Source of Our Food, Big Dreams, and a contribution from our roving reporter Beverly Hopkins, will follow a little later in the programme. But first, discount supermarket sparks row over missing post in Norfolk's poshest town, calls for safety measures as rat-run roadworks diversions cause chaos, mystery as council cancels care deals. However, we lead with Battle of God's Path breaks out in coastal woodland over access rights. The Battle of God's Path has broken out in a town over access rights in a scenic wood. North Norfolk District Council has sparked outrage among the people of Sheringham after closing a well-trodden woodland route over safety fears. Locals who want to use God's Path in Pretty Corner Wood say they have been met with makeshift barricades of chopped down trees and vague signage. The council says the area is unsafe due to what is called unofficial goat paths being created and potentially dangerous trees. However, walkers have been defying authorities by moving debris out of the way and carving their own routes onto the path. This has led to local campaigners applying pressure to the council in an effort to make it reconsider its decision to close the beloved pathway. Emma Thorburn of the Preserve Our Woods, POW, Community Action Group said, "It feels like a war ground. It's so depressing. We want to show the council that people are angry and feel unheard. There is no compromise on the path reopening. They need to listen to reason and compromise. We have had to ask people with chainsaws not to take things into their own hands. People are taking signs down that the council are putting up. God's Path is used by locals because it is usually dry, pretty and accessible. The path is a key access route from Woodland Rise and is just 91 metres in length. The campaigners say the path is more than just a simple trail. They say it's a cherished retreat that offers a slice of heaven with its lush greenery and tranquil beauty, hence the name. One of the committee members said, "We've been told the woodland team can't maintain this entrance, and yet no other part of the woods have had such drastic closures. It feels like the council is quietly reshaping public access without consultation or compromise." POW's key proposal is to reopen God's Path, compromising with the council by using felled trees to define the walkway, and still enhance biodiversity with wildlife habitats. The group is urging the council to work with them collaboratively and is calling for public support to prevent further erosion of woodland access for the community. They say the council's reason for closing the path has shifted from management issues and health and safety concerns to the creation of a wildlife habitat, a process that has involved uprooting healthy plants, saplings, and disrupting the natural flora and fauna. A North Norfolk District Council spokeswoman said, "The council appreciates that everyone wants to enjoy our woodland areas, especially the award-winning Pretty Corner Woods. However, in certain areas of Pretty Corner Woods, where unofficial goat paths have been created, it is necessary to block these off for the safety of visitors and to protect the wildlife habitats within them. In addition to this, there are many areas of woodland which have trees within them that may not be safe for the public to walk near. Many standing trees in these areas provide excellent habitats, but are potentially dangerous. We encourage all residents and visitors to use and visit Pretty Corner Woods. There are 5 waymarked trails which are managed for safe passage and enjoyment. Visitors should keep to these main managed paths throughout the site. The Council has to balance the management of the woodlands, and these practices are standard approaches. There are no plans to allow access through this woodland area. Pretty Corner Woods is a 165-acre patchwork of woodland and heathland, which forms part of a larger network that stretches along the 10-mile Holt to Cromer Ridge. As part of their campaign, POW wants people to attend a public meeting to discuss further action and updates on May the 18th at 7 p.m. in Sheringham Town Council offices.
Tensions are mounting in one of Norfolk's poshest towns after plans to open a discount supermarket sparked a row over missing letters. German giant Lidl has announced it is hoping to open a shop in Holt on land off Nightjar Road, with a store set to form part of the new Heath Farm housing development to the east of the town. The project was revealed last month, and Lidl sent out letters to some people in Holt informing them of the plans. The letters have detailed information about the plans and explained where people could comment or make objections on the application on North Norfolk District Council's website. However, those living closest to the prospective store on the Heath Farm estate itself say they have not received any correspondence. Some members of that community worry that details were intentionally withheld from them to avoid scrutiny. A representative for Heath Farm Estate Residents Group said, "We worry they may have deliberately excluded us. If this is the case, the deception is disgraceful. Everyone should be given the same information." Those living on the estate only discovered that others in Holt had received letters during a public meeting about the project. Despite such tensions, it appears the lack of letters might be simply explained by the fact that Royal Mail is yet to reach every household in Holt. A spokesman for Lidl said the letters had been sent to everyone in the surrounding area, but were posted late last week and may not yet have reached all residents. Lidl say the store will create 40 local jobs and that it will be an energy efficient site providing essential goods to the local community. But the plans, which are yet to be formally submitted to North Norfolk District Council, have already been met with fierce backlash from some of them living in upmarket Holt. The town is known for attracting royalty and celebrities to the boutique shops which line the Georgian High Street. Some have been left wondering if Holt really is a suitable location for the affordable chain. Others are worried that independent traders in the heart of the town could suffer as a result of the store opening. People living opposite to the site have also complained that it will devalue their homes, with a previously pastoral scene turned into a car park. Mandy Beresford, 55, lives with her partner Miles Zambra, 52, next to where the shop could be built. She only found out about the plans after word got around the estate and is yet to receive a letter. She said, "This will be right outside our window. Who wants to look out at a car park? There are already problems with traffic on Nightjar Road, and the noise and pollution will increase tenfold if this goes ahead. Holt is such a beautiful Georgian town. If this gets approved, the town will degrade massively. We already have budgeons in the town centre and great independent traders. They could really struggle if Lidl moves in. We don't need it." Ms. Beresford said people living on Heath Farm Estate were told the land proposed for the Lidl would become housing and not a commercial site, but this appears to have changed. Lidl is holding a local consultation meeting about the proposals on May the 9th at Holt Community Centre in Kerridge Way. Plans will likely be submitted for the new store later this year.
Frustrated locals and campaigners continue to call for road safety measures as a series of rat-run diversions caused by roadworks continue to wreak havoc. People in North Walsham are once again calling for greater safety measures as they say the situation is growing increasingly dangerous. Locals have reported collisions, damage to property, and pedestrians being clipped by vehicles, often finding it nearly impossible to walk down the streets. The main problems are in Aylsham Road, Skyton New Road, Station Road, Millfield Road, and Cherry Tree Lane. The ongoing issues began in January when a £750,000 project to improve the junction of Norwich and Yarmouth Roads on the town's bypass started. People have said it has resulted in narrow pavementless roads used as rat runs, with drivers regularly flouting the 20-mile-an-hour limit. Bernie Marfleet from Save Our Streets campaign group said the situation has deteriorated substantially since January. We have huge volumes of traffic coming through down unacceptable roads, which is leading to collisions, damage to property and personal injuries. We just want to have a dialogue and to be listened to. Anne Isaacson, who has lived on Aylsham Road for 23 years, said, "I'm surprised that nobody has been killed yet. It needs to change. They need to do something. It is not just the speed, it is the size of the vehicles and the volume of the traffic. We've got used to it in a way, but that is not the point." North Norfolk MP Stephen Aquarone said, "I recently spent some time going door to door to speak with residents on and around Aylsham Road who feel that the roadworks and diversions are creating potentially dangerous conditions for road users. Drivers frequently speed, large vehicles attempt to pass each other in these narrow sections, and the damage to road and property is now common. Since the diversion was introduced, the situation has escalated, with abusive behaviour from drivers, increased traffic volume, and real safety concerns for those trying to exit their driveways. There have also been multiple reports of damage on nearby roads like Skyton New Road, including a newly rebuilt wall which has been completely destroyed again, and distressing incidents involving pets. I've raised these incidents along with residents' concerns as a matter of urgency with the Norfolk County Council Highways, and I continue to work closely with councillors Lucy Shires and Saul Penfold to make sure that the issue is kept up on the agenda and that a zero-tolerance approach is being taken to speeding and dangerous driving." The Save Our Streets group says the council's lack of promotion and signage for an official diversion along Old Yarmouth Road is inadequate. The diversions have been caused by works on a £750,000 project aimed at improving the pedestrian safety and traffic flows at the junction of Norwich Road and Yarmouth Road on the town bypass. The works on to the junction, which started on January the 6th, mean the main road entrance and exit to North Walsham are closed until the summer. A council spokesman said, "We've not received any reports of accidents, but we appreciate that there have been an increase in traffic and the surrounding roads whilst these works are being carried out. We've installed additional temporary signage and temporary parking restrictions at key locations since the project began, and we will continue to monitor traffic in the area. Works are on schedule to be completed in June, and the finished project will reduce congestion at the B1150/A149 junction, encouraging more people to use that primary route and then reduce the additional traffic in residential streets for the longer term. The council added that overnight closures of the road would also be required towards the end of the project in order to get the junction resurfaced.
Serious concerns over a company which cares for some of Norfolk's most vulnerable people has prompted a council to cancel contracts worth more than £2 million a year. The unusual action taken by Norfolk County Council against a supported living provider will mean some adults with learning difficulties could have to move out of their homes. County Hall officers will not reveal the identity of the provider, how many people would be affected, or where in the county the supported living is provided at this point, but the authority said it will give more details once the notice is formally served. Officers at the Conservative-controlled council said they became aware of quality concerns with the service in November 2023 and has been giving intensive support to try to turn matters around. But they said serious concerns are still present regarding care planning, staff training and financial policies to protect people living at the services. The council, which pays more than £2 million a year to the company for 9 services, said the provider, which has an inadequate rating from Watchdog's The Care Quality Commission, has not made sufficient progress in remedying failures. Council officers said the provider cannot give confidence that they can improve the care and support to the people currently in their care, so notice will be served on the provider. The council suggests one service is not fit for purpose and should close. Alison Thomas, the council's cabinet member for adult social care, has agreed to serve notice. She also gave the green light for the council to recommission the services to other providers. Supported living is where people with needs receive care either in their own homes or in specifically designed housing schemes. A Norfolk County Council spokesman said, "Following recent service inspections and ongoing intensive support for the provider, we have made the difficult decision to serve notice to a supported living care provider, which provides support and care for residents with learning disabilities in Norfolk. Our residents' well-being is our top priority, and we believe their needs can be better met through alternative provision. While we expect that few residents will need to be moved, we will be meeting with the families involved to discuss individual needs and ensure any changes are made with minimal stress."
A ramshackle structure erected to protect a boat owner's pride and joy will have to be removed after a battle with officials. Kate Gabriel, who owns Sunpenny, a wooden launch located at Womack Staithe near Ludham, has lost an appeal to keep the covering erected at the private mooring. It means the structure has to be taken down following a decision by the planning inspectorate. The planning wrangle began in July last year after the Broads Authority refused permission for an 8-metre cover at Mrs. Gabriel's Manor Gates Garden property. Officers ruled the steel-framed canvas risked harming the Ludham Conservation Area, also complaining it was incongruous and was made with low-quality materials. This led Mrs. Gabriel to appeal to the Planning Inspectorate, the government department that determines planning disputes. In her testimonial, Mrs. Gabriel claimed to be aware of the ecological importance of the area, but argued the structure was of low impact. The structure is designed to be as low profile as possible and is coloured drab olive brown so as to minimise visual impact, she added. She also said she believes the cover created a sheltered habitat for water voles and otters. However, this held no sway with the planning inspectorate, who dismissed her appeal. The official agreed that the cover significantly harms this tranquil part of the Broads, which is surrounded by unspoilt woodland. David Reed, the inspector, said, "The appellant seeks the boat cover to protect the mahogany decks of their launch and damage due to exposure to the weather. The costs of necessary repairs have been considerable and a full-length deck cover would be heavy and cumbersome. These undoubted benefits of the boat cover for the appellant are appreciated but do not outweigh the harm that is caused to the character and appearance of the Loddon Conservation Area.
Go and hug a tree instead. That is the message to animal rights campaigners from the owner of a Cromer crab stall over a nonsense plea to make a town festival more crustacean friendly. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, has sent a letter ahead of Cromer's annual crab and lobster festival, which suggests that its president, Hilary Cox, swaps crabs for apples at its World Pier Crabbing Championships. However, the suggestion that crab apples should replace the North Sea dwellers has met with derision from one of the town's crabbing stalls. The group said, "While crab apples only have peels, crabs have feels. They, like all animals, deserve to enjoy their lives free from human cruelty." John Lee of J. Lee Crab Stall, and whose father was a renowned 8th generation Cromer crab fisherman, said, "What a load of old tosh. It is nonsense. People have been catching crabs off Cromer Pier for years, and the fact that these environmentalists want to change that is completely wrong. They need to get a hobby. If you have enough time to worry about that, then you have not got enough going on. They need to go outside and hug a tree. I feel quite sad for them, honestly. One of the main reasons people come to Cromer is for the crabs." PETA said that crabs could suffer painful injuries when pulled from the sea. The organisation pointed out that even when released back into the sea, injured or stressed crabs may not survive. The letter to festival president and Cromer stalwart Mrs. Cox said that swapping apples for crabs would be greener and kinder, but still fun. Mrs. Cox said, "Taking their concerns into consideration, it is not viable in any shape or form. The organisers of the contest return the crabs safely and sensitively. The idea behind it is really quite daft. Don't apples have feelings too?" PETA also called out commercial fishing as cruel.
A Norfolk MP has joined forces with concerned parents and children of a nursery in protesting its planned closure. Stefan Aquaron attended the protest at East Ruston Primary School and Nursery on Friday. It saw youngsters holding up "Save Our Nursery" signs. The nursery element of the North Norfolk School could close as early as September due to the low number of pupils. The Broad Horizons Education Trust, which runs the school, has blamed the low numbers and a lack of funding for the pending closure, saying that it cannot afford to run the nursery for children aged 2 to 4 years old. North Norfolk MP Mr. Aquaron urged the Trust to reconsider its decision, saying that East Ruston Nursery School must remain open. "It is an important community facility that offers children an education immersed in nature. Closing it down now will not only negatively impact the children who attend it, but will also impact the infant school which it feeds into. Many parents say that the rural location of the school is important for serving the local community, and they now fear for its overall future. They've set up a petition to try and save it, with more than 375 names gathered so far. Rachel Bowley, whose 3 children attend the school and the nursery, said she wanted the school to be accessible for all local children in the future. "Not all settings will be right for all children, but we chose East Ruston because it meets our children's individual needs," she added.
With a heavy heart, a group of wildfowl enthusiasts has handed back the care of a duck pond following the bird flu outbreak. Blakeney Duck Pond had been looked after by the Blakeney and District Wildfowlers Association. The group has ceased their tenure as custodians and handed the care of it back to the landowner. The Wildfowlers Association was responsible for building and maintaining the Blakeney Conservation Duck Pond. The duck pond was established in 1977. The Blakeney and District Wildfowlers Association and associated volunteers announced, following the outbreak of bird flu and having lost all the ornamental ducks, it was with a heavy heart that the Blakeney and District Wildfowlers Association and associated volunteers decided to end the work and involvement at the duck pond after many years. Over the years, it has brought much joy and pleasure to both visitors and locals alike, and hence this was not an easy decision. Blakeney has a long tradition of wildfowling, a very traditional form of shooting over the coastal marshes, which became popular around the end of the 19th century when shotguns became more affordable. The Blakeney and District Wildfowlers Association was formed in 1927. Local wildfowlers had been sourcing food from the marsh in the form of ducks and geese for generations. Some people have taken to Facebook to share their sadness over the association's announcement. One person said, "This is very, very sad news. Well done to everyone who has volunteered over the years." Another added, "It's not easy to maintain this with predation on the rise and the added risk of bird flu. Sad to see, but sadly inevitable." Someone else speculated, "Oh no, that is such a shame. What is going to happen to the duck pond, I wonder? It would be a shame to fill it in." Others expressed nostalgia for the feature, with one person saying, "That is a shame. My late parents used to take my children there in the 1980s. Happy memories."
Mystery surrounds the death of a retired police officer who was found dead inside his home in North Norfolk. The body of Peter Lupton, a Randall Crescent cromer, was discovered inside a bedroom in his house following concerns for his welfare. On September the 28th last year, police officers gained entry into his property where they discovered the deceased 81-year-old. An inquest into his death held at Norfolk Coroner's Court heard that Mr. Lupton was a loner who preferred not to socialise much. His GP confirmed that he did not suffer with any ongoing medical conditions. His neighbours reported not having seen him for months, but it was his daughter who raised the alarm after not hearing from him. Mr. Lupton would usually communicate with her via letters. Area coroner Samantha Goard said, "Unfortunately, the pathologist wasn't able to determine the cause of death. It's always difficult in these circumstances when we are not able to provide the family with any answer as to exactly what the medical cause of death was or the circumstances. It's not possible for us to say whether this was a natural cause death or whether, for example, he may have had a trip or fall and caused himself some injury." Mrs. Goward recorded a brief narrative conclusion. She said, "Mr. Lupton died due to unknown causes, but there was no evidence of suspicious circumstances." The court also confirmed that he had been born in London on October the 3rd, 1942, was a widower and a retired police officer.
A nuisance tenant has been warned he faces jail for throwing a fridge freezer off a first floor balcony after being evicted. Neighbours living below were left terrified after hearing a loud crash when James Taylor, 58, toppled the object over a ledge, causing it to smash onto the ground below. Norwich Crown Court was told he had shouted, "You've got what you wanted, I'm out of here." The incident on March the 5th at John Allison Avenue in Holt came after he had been handed an eviction notice following ongoing issues. Taylor, who has 19 previous offences, including damaging the lectern and urinating on gravestones at Holt's St Andrew's Church, pleaded guilty to destroying property while being reckless as to the risk of whether life would be endangered. The court was told he claimed to have shouted a warning before pushing the fridge from his balcony. But in statements read to the court, neighbours said they had been left living in fear of his future actions. Adjourning sentencing was until May the 7th. Judge Catherine Moore told him she had not ruled out an immediate jail sentence.
A Norfolk Royal National Lifeboat Institution team was called to reports of an unexploded bomb at the weekend. Wells, RNLI, were paged by Humber Coast Guard at 9:51 a.m. on Saturday, as reports emerged that an unexploded bomb had been found on the northeast shore adjacent to the Clyde Channel. Wells RNLI inshore lifeboat, with a crew of three, launched from the north slipway and proceeded down the harbour channel. They arrived on the scene just under 40 minutes after they had first been called upon. The crews took instructions from the local Coast Guard team and they patrolled the channel, acting as a guard vessel and keeping local craft at a safe distance from the area. Just before 11 a.m, a controlled detonation was carried out on the shore, with the bomb declared safe. The inshore lifeboat crew stood down a short while later. The Wells RNLI crew returned to their boathouse at 11:35 and were ready for action again by midday after a washdown and refuelling.
A rogue trader warning has been issued in a North Norfolk village after a cold caller was trying to sell garden furniture. A male had been cold calling at houses in the Wroxham area and had claimed he was selling bankrupt stock garden furniture. The cold caller made several attempts to convince one local that he had already purchased stock from him in order to further sell items to him. Norfolk County Council Trading Standards says that often sellers will use pressure tactics like this, or say that neighbours had purchased items and recommended that the seller call you. Their advice is to never deal with anybody who cold calls at your property trying to sell to you. Cold callers can be reported through the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on free phone 0808 223 1133. It can also be reported to Norfolk Constabulary on 101 or via 999 if you believe that cold callers are targeting vulnerable neighbours or intimidating you.
A string of road closures has been planned in a busy commuter village. Buxton Road and Rectory Road in Horsted, beside Coltishall just north of Norwich, will close for surface dressing works in May. The project will involve lines being painted and road studs being renewed. It will take place in phases so that the road will only need to be closed for a few hours at a time. This will be from 6 a.m. until 4 p.m. on May the 10th and from 7 p.m. on May the 19th until 5 a.m. on May the 20th. A fully signed diversion route will be in operation while the road is out of use. The work is expected to cost around £52,000.
A village primary school where pupils brim with enthusiasm continues to be outstanding, inspectors have said. Neatshead Church of England Primary School was inspected by Ofsted for the first time since 2019, when it was given the highest rating available. And inspectors said the primary, which currently has 68 pupils enrolled, is still meeting the high standard. Laura Davis, head of the school, said, "I could not be more proud of our pupils and staff. Ofsted recognised the love, compassion and empathy which permeate our school. I feel so lucky to work alongside an amazing, dedicated team who go above and beyond for our pupils." The inspection, which was carried out in March, reads, "The school's curriculum is highly ambitious. Pupils gain the knowledge and develop important values which puts them in good stead for the rest of their lives. The school nurtures compassionate, kind young people who understand their responsibilities as global citizens. Mrs. Davies added, I would also like to thank our wonderful church, community and volunteers who support our learning and extracurricular activities.
Those living in a care village have shown their support for a clubhouse to be built near them after plans for the development were lodged. The proposals could see a communal space built for those living at Ashtree Care Village near Reefham. The applicant, Reefham Care Village, has applied to build a clubhouse and management offices on land to the north of Stony Lane. Developers for the applicant said in the submission that the plans were designed to provide a safe and pleasant environment for those living in the care home. They said great consideration has been given to the configuration, siting and orientation of the building within the overall village, with the aim of maximising the views for all the residents and creating a sense of community and belonging. Ahead of Broadland District Council's decision, others have shown support for the plans, including Reefham Town Council. The proposal has also been recommended for approval by those living at Ashtree Care Village, who have said that the clubhouse is urgently needed and that they hope it comes very soon.
Two phases of road closures have been planned for a busy coastal road. Cromer Road, which runs from Munsley to Cromer, will shut for maintenance in May. The work will involve surface dressing, line painting, and cat's eyes being renewed. It will take place in phases so that the road will only be closed for a few hours and access to properties will be maintained at all times. The main dressing will take place from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. on May the 13th to the 15th. The second phase will be carried out from May the 22nd to the 25th during the hours of 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. A fully signed diversion route will be in operation while the road is out of use. The work is expected to cost approximately £197,000.
A young man took his own life after struggling to cope with heartbreaking childhood trauma, a court has heard. Jack Beswick, who was described to Norfolk Coroner's Court as a good man with strong values, died at the age of 26 in November last year. An inquest into his death heard Mr. Beswick was a popular, creative man who studied textile design at university and was planning a new career in carpentry before his death. But on November the 19th, he was found unresponsive in his home in Clye after taking action to end his life. The court heard Mr. Beswick began to struggle with his well-being as a teenager and began to suffer from anxiety linked to his being separated from his birth mother as a child. While he found a secure home with a greatly supportive adoptive mother, with whom he shared a close relationship, his childhood trauma continued to trouble him. In a statement, his adoptive mother told the court, "Jack was such a good man, and I can only imagine the extent of his anguish. I believe he could just no longer live through the pain of his childhood trauma." Meanwhile, she praised the efforts of a police officer to support her son a week before his death, after he suffered a breakdown at his local pub, resulting in a call-out. Mr. Beswick was found in a distressed state and had suffered an injury to his hand in the incident. The attending officer then accompanied him to his home and waited with him until his mother also arrived home. She added, "There is a lot I would change about what happened to Jack, but the response of the police, which was kind and compassionate, is not one of them." Area Coroner Samantha Goward concluded Mr. Beswick had died of a deliberate act, but his intentions were not known.
A former police station in a Norfolk town could be bulldozed as plans for new homes have emerged. Holt Police Station could be demolished as plans have been lodged with North Norfolk District Council, which outline a bid for a new housing scheme. The developer, Hatch Homes, plans to build a cluster of 14 townhouses on the site of the station at Norwich Road. Holt Police Station was built in 1961. A document submitted by the developer said, "The proposed development will provide new homes on a small site in a sustainable location to support the vitality of the rural community of Holt by reusing previously developed land. As such, it meets the above national and local policy objectives." This is not the first time redevelopment of the site has been proposed. In 2020, planning permission was granted to demolish the redundant buildings to make way for 8 homes. Norfolk Constabulary wanted to demolish its building in Norwich Road and build 4 two-storey houses and 4 bungalows on the site, with a short cul-de-sac for access and 14 off-road parking spaces. That bid saw policy say that plans to demolish a station and build the houses in its place would save them about £30,000 a year. It was planned for the police station staff to move into the neighbouring fire station. However, the project was never carried out and permission elapsed in August 2023. At the time of the 2020 bid, Assistant Chief Constable Nick Davidson said, "The relocation will enable Norfolk Constabulary and Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service to be co-located and share the running cost of joint accommodation such as lecture room, kitchen, toilets and showers. The outline application for the new development is to be considered by North Norfolk District Council."
A retirement complex in a North Norfolk coastal town is facing fresh scrutiny due to fears that it has made flooding worse for nearby homes. Sutherland Homes is seeking to vary the planning permission granted in 2011 for its site in Sheringham in Cramer's Drift. The 62-bed complex has been partially completed and some apartments have already been sold, but the firm has since decided it would like to change some aspects of its plans, including its drainage strategy. But concerns continue to mount over claims the scheme exacerbates flooding problems around Knowle Crescent and Knowle Road, about 100 metres away. Liz Withington, a Liberal Democrat North Norfolk councillor for Sheringham, said in a report to officers, "I am not confident that the variations in the drainage plans provide adequate protection to the residents in the areas of Knowle Road and Knowle Crescent. This system continues to rely on the small and often flooded culvert on Knowle Road and Knowle Crescent. The road and gardens in this area are already flooded when it rains, subsequent to the initial development of Sheringham House. Sheringham House sits on a hill that slopes down to the north. Miss Withington believes the removal of a heavily wooded area to make way for the development has meant less rainwater is held. This means greater quantities of surface water are flowing into drains and towards the neighbouring houses than there was before. People have had their gardens regularly swamped by floodwater since the development was built. More than 10 neighbours and Sheringham Town Council have objected to the application. Miss Withington has also called for better maintenance of the surrounding ditches and the culvert, and clarity over who is responsible for keeping these cleared. Despite the concerns from neighbours, Norfolk County Council, which is the lead flood authority, has not objected to the plans, and neither has Anglian Water. North Norfolk District Council offices also recommended that councils approve the scheme when it went before the Development Committee on Friday, May the 2nd.
The full extent of plans for a £350,000 revamp of a seaside town's high street gateway has been revealed by council bosses. A major scheme will see the public space outside the North Norfolk Railway in Sheringham being turned into a new travel hub for the town. Known locally as Ottendorf Green and located on Station Approach, the area is a main gateway to the High Street, situated between the town's main car park, bus and rail links, and the North Norfolk Heritage Railway. It will see the replacement of the existing brick bus shelter, providing improved safety and accessibility with lighting and a larger waiting area for passengers. A new bus shelter will also be built, and a cycle repair area and a water bottle filling station will be created. The details have been revealed by Norfolk County Council and Sheringham Town Council. The budget for the scheme is £358,000, which will be funded as part of Norfolk County Council's bus grant and £8,000 funding from the Town Council. There will also be the installation of a new bus shelter and widened footway at the western end of Station Approach, and a new shelter for cycle parking, equipped with a cycle repair station and a water bottle filling station. A passenger travel information in real time via a digital screen and new seating areas and public information boards will also be added. Norfolk County Councillor Graham Plant, Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, "The current bus shelter is inaccessible with limited pavement space in an area of high footfall. So, this redesign will create a safe and accessible space for all and support the growth of tourism in the town with additional facilities for visitors." The councils are seeking views on the plans and have provided an online survey which closes on May the 26th. Visit www.norfolk.gov.uk/article/68881/Sheringham-travel-hub. There will also be informal drop-in sessions happening on May the 14th at North Norfolk Railway Station Buffet between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m. or Sheringham Community Centre between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m.
You are listening to edition number 1966 of The Martler, recorded on Friday the 9th of May 2025. We have articles about a Norfolk charity's new boat, Delia's podcast, a seaside celebration, and a 20-year-old opening a new bar, plus the Martler magazine supplement. But before that, we have letters to the editor with topics: bus reroute is needed and village help has been offered, plus details of some what's on events.
This letter is from Tony D. Triggs from Trunch. "Since February, I have been suggesting in various quarters that rerouting bus service X6, North Walsham to Great Yarmouth, might be better for travellers and more economic. A holding message from our MP, Steph Aquarone's caseworker, 2 months ago is the best I've had by way of a response. These buses would surely attract more passengers if they served a more populous route. This would be accomplished if they ran via Munsley and then followed the B1159 Parston, Backton, Keswick, Walcott, almost to Stalham, and then directly to join the present route at Yarmouth Road. I estimate that the number of people served, i.e. within half a mile of this route, would exceed the number served at present by 5,000 in winter and 10,000 in summer, with an increased running time of only about 8 minutes, so about a minute per 1,000 potential passengers on average. Because of some overlap, adjustment of the present service 34A might then be possible, yielding an overall better service for the same or less cost. With Great Yarmouth and also the new places served being holiday destinations, I suggested that a bus on this route would attract a recreational day trip clientele, and that such a service launched ahead of the summer season would therefore be off to a good start. Surely this idea deserved a timely response one way or another.
This letter is written by Jane Maguire of Aldborough Mill. I take issue with the implied criticism from former councillor Mr. Graham Jones, NNN Letters of the 24th of April, that Aldborough is not a sufficiently caring community. As former chair of the charity Aldborough and Thurgerton Village Care, I can assure readers that numerous attempts have been made over a long period of time to support the gentleman to whom Mr. Jones refers. Our local community, social services and other agencies have all offered support. It is ultimately a decision for individuals whether or not to respond to those reaching out to them. Some people choose not to avail themselves of all the many avenues of support available in Aldborough, especially to the elderly and the lonely. Acceptance of help is not straightforward and it cannot be forced. It is not helpful to suggest that someone should simply get their finger out in order to address their needs.
Some forthcoming events include on Sunday the 11th of May, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m, a spring sale in Smallborough Village Hall. 9:30 to 2:30, Native to Norfolk Reefer Market at Station Cafe. And 12 noon to 9 p.m. in Aylsham, VE Day 80th Commemoration Street Party in the Marketplace with music and vintage vehicles.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include an anniversary at Blickling, where our food comes from, and dreaming big. But first, Mike Liggins looks back at times spent on the Broads. 18 months on from leaving the BBC, people occasionally ask me if I miss it. The answer is, I miss the good bits. I miss some of the people, and I miss making films about lovely people and places. When I think back now, I can remember making lots of films on the Broads, and the images start to flash through my mind. One image in particular is fixed in my brain. It was the late 90s, and I was working for a regional programme called Out and About. Making a film about a day out on the Broads, I'd borrowed a motor cruiser, and in some beautiful spring weather, the crew and I were heading down the River Waveney towards Lowestoft. Out of nowhere, a marsh harrier swooped down and flew alongside the boat for a while. This big, beautiful bird wanted to see what we were up to, and the cameraman, Duncan Fairs, managed to get a fantastic close-up of it. I miss moments like that. On the same trip, we paid a visit to the now-defunct Sailing Craft Museum at Alton Broad and filmed a sequence of me sailing a Chinese junk, of all things. It was huge, and although I'm no expert, I can remember it was really very hard to manoeuvre. For comic effect, we also put me in a tiny coracle, which I couldn't steer, so I just bobbed about on the Broad. Over the years, I must have been on every type of waterborne craft there is. Wherries, paddle steamers, sailing yachts, various, day boats, canoes and paddleboards, to name just a few. Wonderful memories. The wildlife on the Broads is amazing, and if that's your thing, I'd recommend the Norfolk Wildlife Trust's reserve at Hickling Broad. A boat trip at Hickling is a special thing indeed. Or how about meandering slowly among the reeds? The Broads Authority run trips from Howe Hill on an electric boat, and that too is magical. Like everything else, the Broads have changed a lot in the past 40 years. I recently found a Facebook group called Norfolk Broads Everyday Photos, Videos and Wildlife. And it does what it says on the tin. There are lots of lovely photographs of the Broads, of the boats, the people, the wildlife and the landscape. There's a fair amount of nostalgia in there too, with members posing pictures of family holidays in years gone by, and I do like seeing photos of those lovely old wooden motor cruisers. Too costly to maintain, there aren't many of them left now, sadly. As a family, we've had many happy holidays on the Broads. I love the peace and quiet of the Broads, and the idea that you can be close to civilization but feel you're a million miles away from it at the same time. The children loved getting a boat when they were small, jumping on and off to brew up or stop for a picnic. We all remember one very chilly Easter trip when we all slept in our clothes and woolly hats because it was so cold. On another occasion, I also remember my wife, Janet, trying to moor our boat at Salus Broad. It was busy, so we had to back up and moor end on, as it were. She's a very good driver normally, but on this occasion, she forgot that boats don't have brakes and slammed into the bank at such a rate that all the teacups fell off the galley work surface. Happily, the boat wasn't damaged, but I guess they're built to withstand such dodgy seamanship. You do have to be careful on the Broads. I remember several moments filming and with the family, which weren't quite so funny as Jeanette Sellers' incident. Any type of water can, if you're unlucky, be unforgiving. So if you are venturing out this spring, do take care. But the Broads are a filmmaker's paradise, and although I do miss the BBC, I'm hoping my new freelance career will take me there soon. This article by Mike Liggins appeared in the May 2025 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, marking a special anniversary at Blickling. Looking out at the tranquil rolling countryside of the Blickling estate today, it's hard to imagine that 80 years ago it was a hive of activity that was home to more than 3,000 RAF servicemen and women. RAF Alton was an airfield on the estate. Opening in June 1940, it undertook vital work for the war effort until May 1945. The hall and the surrounding estate provided accommodation for the air crew, ground crew and WAFs, Women's Auxiliary Air Force, who lived and worked on the site. There is a permanent museum which tells the story of RAF Alton upstairs in the East Wing at Blickling, in what was once a sleeping area for NCOs, non-commissioned officers, who had to be promoted through the ranks. The museum showcases the personal stories of the people who served there and the cutting-edge top-secret technologies they used to keep the country safe. From May the 8th to the 11th, a series of special events will be held at Blickling to mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day and the role that RAF Alton played in the war effort. Between 1940 and 1943, two group bombers flew from a grass airfield. The aim was to attack continental Europe and weaken the enemy's ability to fight. From late 1943 to early 1944, the airfield was rebuilt with concrete runways which supported larger, heavier aircraft. The base became the centre for 100 Group, which flew covert radio and radar countermeasure missions to confuse German radar and contributed to the success of significant operations, including the D-Day landings in 1944. Paula McGeechie is Senior Visitor Experience Officer at Blickling Estate. She says the museum aims to shine a light on some of the lesser known work that was done during the war and the people behind it. The aircraft from RAF Alton helped with what they called Operation Overlord at the time, using radio countermeasure devices to confuse German radar and air defences, says Paula. They would go up with things to jam signals, or they would release strips of aluminium that they called window, which they dropped out, and it would create the illusion of lots of aircraft on enemy radar, so they would be confused as to where the aircraft were. and it was basically to create cover for the D-Day landings. At the time, it was top secret, so planes that had this equipment on would be heavily guarded overnight. Even some of the people working on the base didn't know what was happening until the next day, until they knew whether it had been successful. Exhibits in the museum include photographs of the estate and stories. We've got personal stories of people who lived and worked here, everything that they got up to, swimming in the lake, cycling into Norwich to go to dances. We've got some amazing personal insights. Over the years, we've had people who were working here come back and visit the museum and share their stories, not just about the work that was done, but how they spent their leisure time. It's really fascinating, says Paula. They've also got some accounts of how VE Day was marked on the estate. They talk about how one day it was a hive of activity, and then the next day everything just went quiet and people didn't know what to do with themselves. And then when they realised what had happened, they had a huge party on the camp. They had a huge bonfire and someone said they roasted a sheep, which was their first experience of a barbecue, says Paula. The museum is run by a team of 25 volunteers. In the past, we've had people who worked here during the war who came back and became volunteers at the museum, unfortunately no longer with us, says Paula. We've got people who are RAF veterans, who are really into the technology and the history, and we've got some people who are just really into museums. They're all really passionate and happy to chat, share stories or hear stories. They often tell me about people who just come in and find their relatives in pictures on the wall. It can get quite emotional sometimes, I think. Paula's favourite exhibit is a Morse code machine, which is particularly popular with children. They find it really interesting and they can spend ages sending messages. It brings it to life. Rather than it just being the story, they get to experience what it would have been like and the equipment that would have been used, she says. That article by Emma Lee was taken from the May 2025 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Beverly Hopkins, where she talks to modeler Mary Beattie about a special challenge.
Hello, Mary. Thank you for agreeing to talk to our listeners here at Mardler HQ. Perhaps you'd like to introduce yourself and tell us what you're going to talk about.
Hello, my name is Mary Beattie. I am a retired infant teacher and I have led a very full retirement. I don't like to sit still. I'm always active. But over the past 3 to 4 months, I set myself a challenge. And the challenge was to raise money for Dementia UK. And my challenge was to swim the channel. And I have swum the channel, not in the sea, but in a swimming pool. And I did 21 miles in a swimming pool.
Which is the length of the channel,
as I understand it. The length of the channel is 21 miles, yes. So I started it on January the 8th, and I finished it on March the 28th. I probably would have finished it a little bit earlier, but unfortunately I was ill in the middle of it, so I had to miss 2 weeks. What I did was I swam 2 miles a week. So I would go on a Monday morning and swim 1 mile. On a Wednesday I'd do half a mile, and on a Friday I'd do half a mile. And I did the entire thing at the sports park at the UEA. Now the sports park swimming pool is a 50 metre Olympic pool, and I calculated that to get the mile in I had to swim 32 lengths. So I was up early every Monday at 5:15, and I made sure I had a good breakfast. I tried it once without a breakfast, and that was the most silly thing to do because I felt quite ill. So I made sure I had a really good breakfast, and then I left the house at about 6:15 and drove from my home over to the UEA, parked up by about 6:50, and then got into the pool area dead on 7:00.
Did you do it that early so that you were in there on your own?
No, oh no. That was an interesting thing, because I soon discovered that when I got in there to get changed around about 6:45, the changing room was absolutely full. And that is because there are a lot of competition swimmers who use that pool. And they were in there from 5:30. So they were all coming out as I was getting ready to go in. I got to know them, actually, and they knew what I was doing, and we had a good chat about things. So anyway, 6:50, 7:50 found me in on the pool side. That swimming pool operates a barrier system. Mm-hmm. So at certain times of the day, they put a barrier across, and it makes one half of 25 metres quite shallow and the other half of 25 metres deep. But the times I went, I made sure that the barrier wasn't there. 7:00 in the morning, when the competition swimmers were coming out, I was able to go in. And so I would go in at 7 on a Monday and 7 on a Wednesday. On a Friday, for various reasons to do with the pool, it didn't open to the public till 9:45. Okay. So that was a later start. But by then, I mean, I'd licked it. So the worst one was the Monday, because 32 lengths is a long time.
It is. How long does it take?
My slogan was slow as a sloth, because I am not a fast swimmer. Believe me, I am really, really slow.
But you must be a good swimmer.
No, I have got stamina. I can keep going. Right. But I wouldn't say that I'm a good swimmer, which brings me to one of my very funny stories. I do have a friend who is a very good swimmer. She's quite amazing. She offered to come with me. So I met her one evening, because she works all the time, and so went into the pool. Now, to do a mile was, as I said, 32 lengths. That particular evening, the barrier was across. So to do half a mile, I had to do 32 lengths. So I was going and swimming along, and she was the other side in a very fast lane. And as I was swimming very slowly, all I could see was her arms windmilling past me the entire time. And when I got out, I said, gosh, I'm so tired. I've managed to do my 32 lengths. How many did you do? And she laughed and said 99. So that puts it into proportion how slow I am. It was very fast. So that was one quite funny thing that happened. So yes, I kept going every week, and I started a GoFundMe page. I put it out to everybody I knew, who in turn passed it on to people they knew. But at present, I have raised £1,221, which is going to go to Dementia UK. The reason I chose Dementia UK was because of my mum. She was originally from Lowestoft, and she was always in the sea. She used to tell me stories about how she was late for work because she'd go in the sea before she went to work. She told me one funny story about how when she went to work, people commented on her wet hair. And she said that was because she couldn't get home to get her hair dry because there was a bridger. Bridger was what the local people called the bridge when it opened up to let the boats through.
Wow,
so she claimed that that made her late because there was a bridger. So we used to laugh about this. So anyway, she was always swimming, and she taught me to swim in the sea. Yeah, I can still picture her as quite an elderly lady going in the sea in her shorts. But sadly, she did eventually succumb to dementia. I felt that that was a cause true to my heart. The other funny story, there were quite a few of us standing there, and I had got to know two or three people, and one gentleman in front of me looked at the rest of the people in the line and said, "This lady is swimming the channel in the swimming pool," to which a voice behind me said, "Oh, I've done that. I've done it for real." I said, "You've swum the real channel?" And then she said, "Yes, 5 times. I said, okay. And then she said, "I'm doing it again in August, and I'm doing it backwards." So make of that what you will.
And what stroke did you use?
Breast stroke. Or side stroke. Uh-huh. Or a bit of front crawl. Yeah. Or basically anything that would keep me up in the end.
Yeah, yes, understood. So, Mary, the obvious question is, are you going to do it again?
Well, I dare say I will, because, I mean, I've done so much swimming anyway. I intend to carry on, but I will be starting up again next week. And I think, as I said to them, I'm actually just going to go and do a few lengths. I'm not going to go and do this 32 length thing.
No.
And the final thing I would say about it is that I've never, ever liked to use the word boring in my life. I think, you know, things aren't boring. You can always find something interesting in everything.
Oh,
that was boring. It was so boring. I tried not to be bored by it, but just going up and down and up and down for 2 hours, watching people come and go. And I'd go in at 7 with everybody, and at 9 o'clock, I was the only one in there.
Okay.
And they have to keep 3 lifeguards in there while there's someone in the pool.
Oh,
and
do they?
I had to get that mile in, and it was, it's hard going by the end. And I did find it boring, to the extent that I counted the window panes.
People count bricks, don't they?
Yeah, that's right, yes. Understood. And the ceiling and all sorts of things.
Mary, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And now, people have an appetite to learn about where their food comes from. When you're as passionate about a subject as I am, writing about food and drink doesn't really feel like work. I have written more than 250 of these columns over the past 10 years, and it has been something of a labour of love. However, nothing really beats getting out there and meeting the people who produce the wonderful food and drink in our region. And at the weekend, I was in a very privileged position to do just that, hosting the Cookery Theatre at the East Anglian Game and Country Fair at the Euston Estate near Thetford. It was gratifying to see the large audiences who came in from the sunshine, to watch some of the region's top chefs demonstrate their expertise and showcasing the best of what Norfolk and Suffolk has to offer. I will confess that one of the demonstrations had made me a little nervous in advance. Simon Whitehead is not a chef, but instead an all-round countryman. You might know him from his TV appearances on programmes such as Channel 4's Food Unwrapped or The Great British Food Revival, or from his best-selling cookbook, Ahead of the Game. But his day job is a rabbit controller, and he came to the stage with a mission to inform everybody about how important rabbits are, both as part of the natural countryside ecostructure and also as a source of food. As part of this, he brought a whole rabbit, fur still on, and demonstrated live on stage how to butcher, clean, and prepare it to be eaten, going on to cook rabbit burgers in front of the audience. My nervousness about this was around how the audience would react to being given such a full-on manifestation of the link between a furry animal and what they might have for tea. In an age where most of us encounter food in sanitised, plastic-wrapped packaging, what would be the reaction to Simon giving such a graphic demonstration of what is actually involved if you want to be a carnivore? I needn't have worried. Granted, those attending the show are generally country people who might be closer to these things than a more urban audience. But nevertheless, the level of interest in Simon's demonstration was very encouraging. There were no signs of horror or disgust, just fascination and engagement. I want there to be more of this kind of thing. We shouldn't shy away from the realities of where our food comes from, because that attitude leads us directly to terrible ultra-processed foods which do both us and the planet untold harm. A few years ago, a study was published which showed that most children have no idea where their food comes from. It found that a third of primary school children think that cheese comes from plants, whilst a quarter believe that fish fingers, and the clue really is in the name, were made from chicken or pigs. And who can forget Jamie Oliver going into a classroom and bewildering children with a bunch of broccoli? We think that young people and adults will be horrified to learn the realities of food provenance and that they don't want to know. But this weekend's rabbit demonstration showed that this is simply not the case. The audience, and there were lots of children amongst them, asked plenty of questions and were genuinely engaged with what Simon was saying. What's more, a fair few asked to taste the end product, sadly something you're not allowed to do on a food stage. The disconnect between field and fork is one of the reasons the UK has such an unhealthy diet and such a dysfunctional relationship with food. How can we expect people to be able to construct a nutritious diet for themselves if they don't understand the basics of what they are eating? Unfortunately, in a system where exam results are everything and funding scandalously scarce, there is neither the incentive nor the resources to teach this stuff in schools. Like so many other useful life skills, understanding food, and indeed cooking, is relegated to a low-priority, off-curriculum activity if it is taught at all. Simon Whitehead's demonstrations over the weekend showed that there is a real appetite to learn more about where our food comes from. And for the sake of the nation's health, we need to start prioritising teaching this stuff to children and adults alike. That article by Andy Newman appeared in the EDP on the 30th of April 2025.
And to finish this week's supplement, if you're going to dream, dream big. What is it you dream of? What makes your heart quicken as your bare toes touch the floor each morning? What would you like your life to mean? Those are mighty questions for the start of an article, I'll avow. So let's distract ourselves for a moment with some wildlife. It's May, best month of the year for me, and my windows are open to all the life on the common outside. I can hear birds, of course. The chiff-chaff, who began to sing in early March, is loud still in the nearest willows. In early April, he was joined by his close cousin, a willow warbler, arriving from far further south. He too is still in song today. Unlike the chiff-chaff's cheery chime, his is a song of soul-arresting beauty, slipping down the scale in silvered notes. I can hear mallards too, and the sharp parp of a moorhen. Beneath my open windows is the village pond, crowded today with mother ducks and clouds of piping ducklings. From the reed fringe of the pond, I hear a sedge warbler, filling this bright spring morning with his joyful riffs. Now the birds and I have your attention, let's return to my opening question. What is it you dream of in this life? How would you like to be remembered? These questions matter. Our time on this wondrous earth is short, and our lives only as meaningful as we make them. There are only so many years when you will wake up and, hearing spring's first chiff-chaff, be thankful that grey, cold winter is in retreat. So what's your dream? In my 51 years of life, I have come to realise that rather than dreams for my own, my gratification, the very best are those aimed at delivering a better world. Many kind and generous people dream of a fairer, safer future for marginalised or persecuted groups of people, and they act, while they still have energy and time, to make this dream come true. For my part, and I'm sure here that I speak for everyone who works at Norfolk Wildlife Trust, I dream of a better world for wildlife and people alike, delivered through the restoration of wild habitats and of our beleaguered environment. I chime on about this a lot, somewhat like the chiff-chaff, who has already sung for 2 months outside my window, who will continue singing for 2 months more. But I have plenty of good reasons to chime. My first reason, the reason I have carried with me since I was a child, is that I love wildlife. Wildlife makes my day better every single day. As I lay in bed before first light today, I smiled to hear the blackbird, whose territory covers several small gardens in our village. I defy anyone to listen to a blackbird singing, actually to listen and to think about what he means, and not to smile. For here is a bird, weighing only 100 grams, whose lungs and syrinx are loudly, proudly filling the day with music. I am here, his song says. I am alive, taking my place in the timeless flow of hopes and genes and dreams since life began. All I ask for is a place on earth where it's safe to raise my offspring. Hearing this blackbird for a neighbour brings me joy. Watching large-headed resin bees nest building in my little garden makes me happy. Finding a speckled bush cricket in my flower beds makes me proud to have given her a habitat in which to breed. Nature makes me happy. And nature makes me. Nature makes us all, literally makes us. Whichever way you look at it, you are nature, made of nature. Entirely dependent on nature for everything you are and have and want. It's important in our fast-paced, AI-enhanced, ever-stressed modern lives to remember that everything fundamental about us comes directly from nature. We think of ourselves as exceptional, uniquely smart, uniquely powerful, and to an extent this is true. But we are also part of nature. We're built of the exact same molecules as every living thing on Earth, and plenty of non-living things besides. We share some genes with every other living organism, including paramecia, dinoflagellates, and bacteria, and the majority of our genes with every other mammal, including a rat. We're smart, we're creative, we're destructive, and we're hugely powerful. But we're also just another part of nature, eating food entirely made by nature, grown in soils entirely made by nature, wearing clothes entirely made from nature, drinking water given to us by nature, respiring oxygen wholly derived from nature. And that's the dream, my dream, the dream of everyone who works at Norfolk Wildlife Trust. A world for people and for nature, for people as nature, in which every species, the blackbird singing in the dawn, the polecat hunting in the night, the humble dinoflagellate, has the space and right to thrive beside us. In which every species sustains and nourishes and delights us. At Norfolk Wildlife Trust, we work in 1,000 ways to make our dream reality. We manage nature reserves, restore lost habitats, create new habitats, advise authorities and landowners, campaign for nature, educate and enthuse. Our staff are passionate people working, fighting, dreaming on behalf of nature. But if you're going to dream, dream big. We need you dreaming with us of a better world for people and for wildlife. We need you leaping from your beds each morning, dreaming of a landscape and a seascape rich in life, supporting every Norfolk species and supporting humans. The challenges are enormous. The pace of loss, disastrous. But the dreams, enormous too. And that item is from the Norfolk Magazine, May 2025 edition. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP and Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with Seaside Town to Celebrate 10-Year Partnership. A North Norfolk seaside town will celebrate an important 10-year partnership with a weekend of events. The Sheringham Musilac Twinning Association will mark the 10th anniversary of the official signing of the Twinning Charter by the two town councils and more than 21 years of friendship and visits. Free events will take place in the town on May the 10th, beginning at around 11 a.m. with the crier and local piper at the market and crying down to the shore. There will be an unveiling of an SMTA mural on the seafront wall at around 11:25 a.m, followed by a performance by the Sheringham Shantymen. Activities will run on the Lees between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m, including sand chateau building, which will take place on the beach, a guided four-mile ramble, games for children, and an opportunity for adults to try French pétanque and Breton palais. On May the 11th, a free family fun day Sunday will run at the high school from noon to 4 p.m, with activities and games for youngsters, performed by local groups, and an exhibition of pupils' work from all four local schools. There will also be a display of photos of Sheringham across the years by the local digital photography group.
A former detective has released a new novel inspired by his police work. Sheringham-based author Gary Powell has launched his second detective novel, The Cutting Room, drawing inspiration from his career with the British Transport Police. The book sees the return of Detective Inspector Ryan McNally and Detective Sergeant Marcia Frost, characters first introduced in Mr. Powell's debut novel Mind the Killer. In The Cutting Room, the British Transport Police's major investigation team is faced with the daunting task of solving a complex case involving human remains discovered in left luggage at Liverpool Street Station and on the back seat of a London black cab at Victoria's bus terminal. The only initial clues to the victim's identity are a wedding band and a tattoo. The plot thickens as McNally finds himself standing trial for assault, escalating tensions within the team. The story promises a relentless journey filled with unexpected twists. Mr. Powell presented his new crime novel at a book launch at The Kitchen, 17 Station Road, Sheringham. Mr. Powell, a former London detective, spent most of his career in crime investigation, particularly in the anti-terrorist branch at Scotland Yard and national surveillance teams. He retired in 2011 and now lives in Sheringham, North Norfolk. Mr. Powell has published three true crime books: Death in Disguise, the amazing true story of the Chelsea murders; Death Diary, a year of London murder; Execution, Terrorism and Treason and Convicted, landmark cases in the British criminal history. He also compiled a social history of London squares titled Square London. Mr. Powell is also known as a guide at St. Paul's Cathedral and a public speaker using his true crime books as material.
Former Norwich City majority shareholder Delia Smith levelled a blow at Ipswich Town fans in a recent podcast appearance. Delia and her husband Michael Wynne-Jones appeared on the Talk Norwich City podcast earlier this week to discuss their time at the helm of the club. When asked to give her final message to Norwich City fans, the now honorary life president of the club used the opportunity to remind supporters of the difference between Norwich and Ipswich fans when faced with adversity. Her parting message to fans was, "Thank you for being the best football supporters in the world, because they are the best football supporters in the world. We got relegated and we sold the same number of season tickets. When Ipswich Town were in trouble, their stadium was half empty. Their fans didn't turn up. Our supporters, they always turned up." Delia and Wynne-Jones' time as majority shareholders was brought to an end earlier this year as Mark Attanasio's Norfolk Holdings Group completed its takeover of the club. The two are now bestowed with the title of honorary life presidents of the club. The TV chef was subject to a torrent of abuse the last time the Canaries visited Portman Road. The 83-year-old's car was left damaged after hooligans lobbed beer cans and flares at it. No arrests have been made following the incident at Portman Road, but fans were arrested on both sides following violent clashes before a repeat game in April 2024. The two clubs will do battle again next campaign, with Ipswich Town's relegation confirmed last Saturday following a heavy defeat by Newcastle United. City fans will no doubt be looking forward to the prospect of stretching their unbeaten run against Kieran McKenna's side.
A new bar has opened in a Norfolk town after its 20-year-old owner ditched university plans to pull pints. Spearheaded by Talia Harvey, the Living Room Lounge Bar has opened its doors on Red Lion Street in Aylsham. Possibly the youngest business owner in the town and bar owner in Norfolk, Miss Harvey skipped out on going to university to study law after deciding to realise her dream of running a bar, which she discovered while working at another local watering hole. She said, "I was going to be a lawyer, but working in a bar made me realise I am a people person and I wanted to be behind a bar, so I decided not to go to uni. I think I'm the youngest business owner in the town. It's a huge achievement and I could not have done it without the support of my family. I've been wanting to do it for around 2.5 years. We've had an amazing response. Everyone is loving it, especially couples. People are loving being able to have a cocktail or a Guinness in the same establishment." Miss Harvey added that the idea to combine her love of good cocktails and draft beer under the same roof came after feeling as though there was something missing from the town. She also added that the bar has travel-themed elements, with passport-style menus boasting a range of drinks. They are inspired by her family's love of travel. The bar officially opened its doors on Saturday, April the 26th, after a soft launch the day before. Miss Harvey has said that there may be plans in the future to serve nibbles as well as the current range of beverages.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Martler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. And of course, if you have an iPhone, iPad or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the talking newspaper skill. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room Join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio! Cheerio.